Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Eric Prince, the man who founded the mercenary army Blackwater and the brother of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, was interviewed on NPR's Morning Edition and On Point this week. The interviews came after a New York Times report revealed that Jared Kushner and Steve Bannon are pushing for a plan to privatize the war in Afghanistan, and they want it handed over to Eric Prince, who, according to The Intercept, was under investigation last year by the Department of Justice for money laundering, ties to Chinese intel, and brokering mercenary services in countries like Libya. Kushner and Bannon also reportedly want Steven Feinberg involved. He owns DynCorp. That is the largest U.S. contractor in Afghanistan. Investigative journalist Tim Shorrock has been writing about contractors and the privatization of war for many years. Tim wrote about the plan for the nation, and he's author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. And we're also trying to connect with Ali Latifi, an independent journalist based in Kabul. We want to talk to Ali about his recent reporting and how civilians are being affected by ongoing violence in Afghanistan. And hopefully we'll connect with him in a couple of minutes. Well, Tim, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note by highlighting journalism that stood out. So what caught your attention this week?
Well, I think we have to give kudos to the New York Times for following this Afghanistan story and the role that Eric Prince and Richard Feinberg of DynCorp want to play in this, what they're calling a privatized war. The other day, James Risen and some other reporters did a story about Trump finding a reason for the U.S. to remain in Afghanistan, namely minerals. And this story talked about how DynCorp could play a critical role in, say, guarding mines that the U.S. wants to exploit. So I think the New York Times, you know, deserves credit for following this story. And, of course, they're the ones who broke the story about Eric Prince and Richard Feinberg meeting with Secretary of Defense Mattis at the White House. I would note that one story. Another story I would note is this was on July 24th. This is an opinion story at the New York Times by Steve Early, who is a very good labor journalist in California, and his story is called "The Dangerous Idea: Eliminating the Chemical Safety Board." And it's based on his own reporting from Richmond, California, about pollution in oil refineries and the damage that could be done by Trump basically not, you know, reducing and cutting funding for the U.S. Chemical Safety Board.
Wow.
Steve Early has been doing some excellent reporting on this, you know, for years. And finally, I would note a story by labor reporter Mike Elk, which appeared in the Guardian newspaper this was on July 24th, also Monday, where he did a kind of in-depth look at the organizing campaign by Nissan workers in Mississippi. And of course, there's been a vote has been called by the NLRB for Mississippi workers at the Nissan plant in Canton to vote union, and this campaign has gotten a lot of support from people like. It's gotten a lot of support locally from clergy and ministers in the region. But Senator Bernie Sanders has recently, you know, been going there to speak, and so has, you know, actor Danny Glover and others. And it's a long struggle, and Mike Elk does a good story in The Guardian of talking about the background to this organizing campaign, something I've also covered, and I also wrote about a few months ago for In These Times.
Well, these are great stories. Again, Mike Elk out of The Guardian, pro-union rally in Mississippi unites workers with community, people saying we are ready. And then Steve Early in The New York Times with an op-ed called "A Dangerous Idea, Eliminating the Chemical Safety Board." This is a federal watchdog, and it has 5 board members, a tiny staff of less than 50, and a budget of $11 million a year. And its mission is to investigate fires and explosions in oil refineries refineries and chemical plants. Wow, we've got to do a show about this one. Thank you so much for these, Tim.
You're welcome.
And we'll talk about that New York Times piece in just a couple of minutes. That's Tim Shorrock. He's an investigative journalist who's been writing about contractors and the privatization of war for many years. He also writes about a lot of other issues, including Korea. And now I'd like to welcome Ali Latifi to the show. Ali is an independent journalist based in Kabul. A couple of months ago, he wrote a piece called Mother of All Bombs, A Journey to the Afghan Village, where Donald Trump dropped the biggest bomb. Hi, Ali. I'm so glad we connected with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Ali, as you know, we start off each show on Friday by highlighting journalism that stood out this week. So what caught your attention this week?
Going back to the New York Times, a story that caught my attention that actually has to do with an incident here in Kabul, a friend of mine, Mujib Mashal, wrote about the recent bombing in Kabul that targeted, that ended up causing casualties among workers at the Ministry of Mines. And the story that he wrote was about one female worker at the ministry who comes from a very remote, deeply impoverished province, who ended up getting her master's degree in Japan and was killed in the bombing. And, you know, she became, I remember on that day, sort of, you know, her picture was being circulated everywhere on social media. And he really sort of tracked the story of what it means that these young, educated people who are trying to, you know, help the nation and help, I mean, because you were just talking about Afghanistan's mineral wealth, you know, she was working on that, and she ended up paying the price in this Taliban-claimed suicide bombing. And so I think it's a great story that, you know, once again reminds people that when we talk about bombings in Afghanistan, we're talking about people being killed, people that are not very different from someone, you know, that you may have run into in San Francisco.
I read this story. Her name was Najib Husseini. She was just 28 years old. And she was the main breadwinner for her entire family. Her brothers and sisters were going to school because she was working and making money. And can you talk a little bit more about this? Because this was a very significant bombing. A lot of people were on this bus. I understand a lot of women especially were on this bus.
Right. So basically, the other thing is, like, not only was it the bus, we have to remember the area. Again, this is what keeps happening. So the Taliban gave the excuse. Their so-called justification for the bombing was they were saying that it was intelligence workers on this bus. But, you know, the government replied and said, intelligence staff never goes on a bus. And the site of the bombing was also near a school, like a higher education institution. And so, again, what we're seeing is that it is civilians being targeted. It is either civilian workers within the government or civilians, you know, essentially like crossing the street that are being targeted. And I remember in the morning when the attack happened, a lot of people were talking about how the bombing was in close proximity to the second deputy, to the chief executive of the Afghan government, and they showed a picture of one of his windows, you know, with a crack in it, saying it's near his house. But whenever we talk about things like that and we try and relate it to people who have guards and who have security barriers and who have government protection, you know, we forget, and again, we're giving credence to these sorts of excuses that the Taliban give, we're forgetting that, you know, it is young people, young women, young men. Mm. You know, if you go through the list, they all had at least college degrees, including master's degrees. You know, the list that I saw was 2 women and 12 men from the Ministry of Mines. They all had some sort of a higher education degree. And so it's, you know, this is what's happening. These are the people paying the price for these kinds of things.
Well, thank you for bringing that one up. So kudos to the New York Times' Mujib Mashal, who's reporting from Kabul. Mm-hmm. And the story that he wrote is Living to Modernize Afghanistan and Meeting a Grim End. And that is Ali Latifi, an independent journalist who's joining us from Kabul. And we'll put all of the stories that Tim and Ali recommend at yourcallradio.org. Ali, since you brought up the ongoing violence in Afghanistan, give us a sense of what is happening in Kabul. According to the United Nations, when you look at Afghanistan as a whole, more than 1,700 civilians have already been killed this year.
Right. And we also have to remember that within the first 6 months of 2017, because if we're coming back to Kabul, according to the UN, the highest rate of civilian casualties are in the province of Kabul. And within that, the majority of those would be in the city of Kabul. And again, this comes back to this idea by the European Union that, you know, there are safe spots in Afghanistan, and obviously the if they don't point out any other city, the one that they would point out to is Kabul. But again, we're seeing that, the statistics are proving that, you know, it's not true anymore. You know, we've always said in Afghanistan, anyone you talk to, the saying is always like, we don't know when we go outside if we'll make it back home alive. Mm. And more than ever now, you know, that is becoming the reality of the situation. So you have this ongoing war. You have the stagnated economy with something like last year, the last estimate was something like 40% unemployment. You have more schools across the country being closed due to insecurity. And it's just sort of this war that's dragging on, and no one really knows what the end of it will be. And again, you know, the U.S. keeps teasing like, oh, maybe we'll send more troops, or maybe we'll find a new way to invest, but there are still no solid answers.
What is it like for journalists? What is it like for you to report on this? According to the Afghan Journalist Safety Committee, at least 10 journalists were killed in Afghanistan in the first half of this year. This is a 35% increase over last year.
I mean, the dangers are still there. The dangers are there as they've always been. You know, you have the dangers of the armed opposition targeting you. You also, in Afghanistan, you have the dangers of strongmen and warlords and powerful politicians targeting you. And you also have the dangers of being caught. If you're not killed by, you're not likely to be killed by the government, but you are likely to face harsh treatment or efforts to try and keep you from reporting this story. I mean, Afghanistan still has a very much of a free press compared to the rest of the region, even Turkey, but there are instances where you see that, you know, even within the government, they're not cooperating. And the thing is, because the war is spreading and it's becoming more prevalent, and bombings and things like that are becoming more prevalent, you're more likely to get caught up in the crossfire.
Tim Ali pointed out this piece in the New York Times about civilian deaths. What are your thoughts about media coverage of civilian deaths in the United States, specifically talking about what's happening in Afghanistan?
Well, the coverage is slips through the cracks. I mean, you see very little, really, about the true impact of what's going on in Afghanistan in the media. I mean, you have to look for stories like this in the New York Times. It's very unfortunate. I mean, there has been some attention paid recently to the, you know, Saudi, the U.S.-funded Saudi war in Yemen, which is causing, you know, terrible casualties among civilians, massive casualties. And it's an inhumane war and attack that's going on there that unfortunately, you know, really is getting very little attention. One thing that I sort of noticed in this story, though, that Ali was just talking about, is that, you know, it's a terrible tragedy what's happened to these people, civilian workers like this. This young woman who is trained in Japan and wants to do her best to help her country recover from years of war. It seems very unfortunate, though, that this looks like a strategic attack by the Taliban. Mm. I mean, it's the mine and mineral, you know, agency, and you know, they you know, people in the Taliban must read the New York Times, and they must understand that you have, you know, this investor Richard Feinberg at DynCorp, you know, aiming to get his hands on, this attempt to exploit Afghans the mineral resources. So I think they're related, and I think that's part of the tragedy of what's unfolding in Afghanistan and throughout the Middle East, is that you have this use of private companies to exploit the war and to gain from the war and to actually, you know, in this case, probably exploit the Afghans' mineral wealth. So You know, there's got to be a better way to bring peace to Afghanistan besides, massive amounts of U.S. forces and this potential use of say, Eric Prince's Black Bot or private security force.
Ali, to take Tim's comment about the Taliban, according to reports, the Taliban claim that they control about 40% of the country, especially provinces in the south. Is this true? And as a journalist, how can you confirm this number?
So most of the reports say that it is true. It's about 35 to 40%. The thing we have to remember is that and this is, again, the tragedy of the ongoing war, is that we have, so in the last week, you know, there were districts in the central province of Ghor, in the northern province of Faryab, and somewhere else, I can't remember at the moment, where, you know, it has gone back and forth between government and Taliban hands. And this has been happening since, essentially, the beginning of the war, where they're basically trading hands between one another. Where, you know, a district or, you know, in the case of Kunduz, a provincial capital could fall to the Taliban and then it gets taken back. And it's become this sort of cat and mouse game that, again, I said this repeatedly, you know, it's basically hindering people's lives even more. It's causing, you know, we have higher rates of IDPs than ever because people are being forced to leave these provinces and come and seek refuge in other provinces and in other major cities, which is, again, putting strains on these cities and these neighboring provinces. And it's become this issue of, again, like no one is taught, like, so they're talking about mineral wealth, and they're talking about private security forces, but no one is really talking about, okay, how do we put an end to these games, and how do we really make a peace? How do we bring an end to this war? It's all about maybe there'll be more troops, maybe there'll be more investment, maybe we'll exploit the mineral wealth, which is incredibly difficult in this country because the government mining institutions aren't set up for it. A high percentage of the mines in the country are essentially illegal, controlled by strongmen. And access to those mines in those areas is not easy to get. And so if you're getting these private security firms to basically secure these mines and the areas around it, what does that mean for securing civilians? And what is really the thought in terms of bringing peace? Because that's the one thing no one is talking about at this moment, is how do you come to a negotiated peace? Is there a way to figure that out? You know, and the other thing you have to remember in terms of mines is extractive industries rarely help out the country that you're taking the resources from. I mean, think about the African continent. What mineral, resource, stone doesn't grow in different parts of the African continent, but look at their economy because, you know, of these extractive industries. They're not made to benefit the country that the resource is being taken from, especially in a country like Afghanistan, where, like I said, the vast majority of mines are not under government control.
Ali Latifi is an independent journalist based in Kabul, and Tim Shorrock is an investigative journalist. He writes about the privatization of war. We'll be talking about that in just a couple minutes. Ali will be with us for the next 5 or so minutes. He's joining us from Kabul. So if you have any questions or comments for Ali, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. You both have been referencing this New York Times story about Donald Trump and Afghanistan. It's called Trump Finds Reason for the U.S. to Remain in Afghanistan, Minerals. According to the piece, Afghanistan's mineral wealth, his advisors and Afghan officials have told Trump that they could be profitably extracted by Western companies. And Ali, how have things on the ground in Afghanistan changed since Donald Trump became president?
There have been more airstrikes, more drone strikes, more civilian casualties. Again, something that was pointed out in the New York Times, in the last 2 weeks, there have been 2 airstrikes in Helmand province in the south, and in the Nahal province in the east that have resulted in the deaths of civilians and of our national security forces. In the case of Mindanao, there's these back and forth. You know, some people, the government is trying to say that these were quote-unquote Daesh militants, not civilians, but most of the reports on the ground say that it was civilians. And in Helmand, it was members of the Afghan National Security Forces that were killed. And so in that case, you know, the war is not coming to an end, and there aren't any solid answers. And if anything, drone strikes and airstrikes are up, which means that just by the sheer statistics and the way, and we have to remember that under Obama, there were massive civilian casualties that, you know, the government wouldn't necessarily report due to these drone strikes and these airstrikes, and that has not subsided under Trump.
Right. Tim, that's an important point. There were massive civilian casualties because of drone strikes under President Obama.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think the policies are, you know, haven't really changed that much from this from the past administration to this one. This, you know, although Trump seems a little more willing to use airstrikes and drone strikes, as Ali was just talking about. But the fact is that there's no, you know, attempt to really bring peace to Afghanistan and to resolve these issues. You know, one of the stories I didn't want to mention, this is a good story, but I mean, there's a news release the other day that plays right into this. DynCorp lands $217 million contract modification to extend U.S. Army support in Afghanistan. This is under the LOD cap, its massive contract with the U.S. Army awards, and this is to support in Afghanistan. You know, it's all this logistics support that DynCorp provides to the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. So, you know, it so happens that it won this contract, you know, a few days or a few weeks after these meetings at the Pentagon that supposedly, you know, Mattis turned his nose down on, you know, privatizing, but DynCorp is still getting a lot of business out of this war. And what I fear in this kind of privatized situation is, I mean, you know, we've seen in Iraq how the U.S. during the counterinsurgency campaign, you know, would work with so-called strong men and warlords in Iraq, and I think that there's a history of doing that in Afghanistan as well. So what Ali was talking about, you know, some of these mines and, you know, mineral wealth controlled by strong men, you could have a guy like, you know, Eric Prince controlling a private army, cutting deals with people like that who are, you know, really against the interests of Afghanistan people to exploit the mineral wealth. And I think that's one of the real dangers of privatized war. I mean, you know, they don't have any, they can't help negotiate a peace. Their business is war. They're not interested in resolving the conflict. The conflict plays into their hands. The conflict helps make profit for them. And it's a direct contradiction. I mean, you can't have that with a U.S. If the U.S. government is earnestly, you know, trying to develop some kind of peace in Afghanistan, privatizing is the worst possible way you could go.
And as you report, Tim, and we'll talk about this after the break, when wars are carried out by paramilitary units, they are subjected to less oversight than the military. And we'll talk about that after the break. Ali, before we let you go, what are you hearing from Afghans on the ground? You're in Kabul. You've been talking about what is the path toward peace. What are Afghans saying?
In terms of
what they'd like to see, what changes they'd like to see to end, to stop the violence, to stop the
and
drones,
the
to stop the airstrikes. Right.
And an end to the war, you know, however that is achieved. Obviously, there are people with business interests who want, you know, more troops, who feel like that will, you know, help bring peace, that will try and prevent the chaos from the civil war that erupted after the end of the Soviet occupation. But at the end of the day, what people want is an end to the war and an end to the killings, because, you know, on May 31st, we had probably the worst bombing in Kabul that anyone remembers, you know, since the Civil War and the Soviet occupation. And so it's really become, like, it's been a very tough summer. People didn't get to enjoy the month of Ramadan. They didn't get to enjoy the Eid holidays. They're not getting to enjoy the summer. You know, the electricity is going out. It's gotten hotter than it's ever been. And on top of that, there's still violence. At the end of the day, what people want is an end to the war and, a stable economy, for people to go back to work and to be able to continue their lives. But again, we have a situation where when people are on their way to work, they're being killed.
Well, Ali Latifi, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
That is Ali Latifi, an independent journalist based in Kabul, and you can find his latest stories. He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times a couple months ago called Mother of All Bombs, A Journey to the Afghan Village, where Donald Trump dropped the biggest bomb. And coming up after the break, we'll continue our conversation with investigative journalist Tim Shorrock about private contractors and the privatization of war and media coverage of these very important issues. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we're going to have a conversation about the health insurance industry. We'll talk about its history, how it operates, how it makes decisions, how it makes its money. This is a very important conversation, especially right now. A little later in the show, we'll talk about media coverage of what went down last night in Washington, D.C., with the latest Republican healthcare bill. And then on Tuesday, ProPublica reporter Jesse Eisinger will join us to talk about his new important book called The Chicken S Word Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. I hope you can join us for those shows. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable. If you'd like to join us, if you have anything to add, we're going to speak with Tim Shorrock about the privatization of war and contractors. And then the last 5 or 10 minutes, we'll talk about what happened last night in Washington, D.C. Tim has been writing about contractors and the privatization of war for many years. Tim wrote about a plan that was first reported in the New York Times about Jared Kushner and Steve Bannon pushing to privatize the war in Afghanistan. Tim wrote about that for The Nation. You can also check out his book, Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. And Tim, it's important to point out that this obviously did not start with Donald Trump. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism reported back in January that there were 10 times more airstrikes in the so-called War on Terror during Obama's presidency than under George W. Bush. Obama embraced the U.S. drone program, overseeing more strikes in his first year than George W. Bush carried out during his entire presidency. Can you talk about that, Tim, and how that...
I'm not surprised to hear... I'm familiar with that, and I'm not surprised to hear that at all. I mean, I think, Obama was calling was himself calling... of approving airstrikes, from the Oval Office, CIA's drone strikes, with his approval. And so he was very deeply involved in this. And I think Obama's foreign policy, over the 8 years he served, there was, serious problems with it from all angles. I mean, I think his policy on North Korea, for example, it helped bring about the crisis we have now. Because they refused to negotiate with North Korea in any kind of meaningful way. And I think his policies in Afghanistan and the Middle East have helped create more terrorism because of the attacks on civilians, and this relentless attacks on civilians in Yemen as well. So I think that's no surprise.
Tim, it's important to point out also, Senator Al Franken has been making the rounds. He wrote a new book about his time in the Senate. And recently in Berkeley, I believe it was, the journalist and author David Talbot interviewed Al Franken. And on stage, he said, "Can you tell me the last time when politicians and specifically Democrats have had a real in-depth debate about war and military spending?" And he stumped Al Franken. He said, "Honestly, I can't answer your question."
No, it's very sad to see the Democrats' response to all our wars right now. I mean, they're more hawkish on North Korea than a lot of Republicans are.
Hmm.
And I think it's a really dangerous trend. I mean, it used to be that when there would be hearings in the Senate, years ago, say around the war in Vietnam, there was deep questions about the purpose of the U.S. policy and what the U.S. was doing and the impact on civilians and so on. Now you go to a Senate. I went to a Senate hearing the other day on North Korea, and some of the most hawkish voices were on the Democratic side.
Mm.
And so I fear for the country with the lack of they have this huge investigative powers at their fingertips, and they could bring to the American people the truth about the role of the U.S. in creating and deepening the crisis in say North Korea, as well as deepening the wars in Afghanistan and the Middle East. But they just push this hawkish agenda to make them look different than the Republicans, and so I find that really sad. What I've been writing about this privatization of the war in Afghanistan in particular, of course, deepened with Obama as well. I want to mention this. There's a report coming out on Monday. It's embargoed for now, but it's a U.S. government watchdog in Afghanistan. And one of the things they're going to say, I got a release on this, embargoed release on this today. It says that they're concerned about whether all the U.S. agencies that are in Afghanistan, State, AID, Justice, Treasury, etc., this report's going to say that they cannot oversee the billions of dollars the U.S. is dedicating to Afghan reconstruction because they cannot leave the U.S. embassy compound.
Wow.
And it says in the long run, such extreme risk aversion and avoidance may contribute to greater insecurity, since it limits U.S. diplomatic reach to the very Afghans necessary to foster stability. So, our war, the war we're carrying on, is making U.S. even more isolated in Afghanistan. They have no control over all the funding, all the billions of dollars they're spending. There's no accountability for it. And, of course, if it's turned over completely to private hands, that gets even worse.
What do you think this issue doesn't get more attention, Tim? In December of 2015, ProPublica tallied up $17 billion in wasteful spending by the U.S., $8 billion earmarked to fight the drug trade, $2 billion on the construction of roads, $486 million on cargo planes that were never used for lack of spare parts. I mean, a lot of companies are making a lot of money off of this. Why doesn't this get more scrutiny in the media?
I think it's hard for the media to get its hands around the fact that both the military operations and intelligence are actually, they're actually almost become a private enterprise. And you can't really talk about U.S. intelligence, as I've been saying for years, without talking about the degree of privatization.
Mm.
I mean, you have, as I reported like 10 years ago, 70% of the U.S. intelligence budget goes to private contractors. And what that means is that, it's private entities that have do the bulk of the work in the U.S. intelligence. And so it's a public-private, it's a for-profit enterprise, really. You can't talk about U.S. intelligence without talking about contractors. Yet so many people in the press and the media, including the left media, continually to talk about intelligence as if it's just only the government. They give this misimpression to the public, I think, that it's just a public enterprise, but it's not. It's private money very deeply integrated with all these operations. And I think that somehow that's got to change that view. I mean, when you write about, when journalists write about, you know, bombing or an military operations in any country, I think they need to bring into play and expose the private interests that are involved in those same operations. A year ago or so, I published an article in The Nation about the degree of concentration within intelligence, and the story talks about five corporations that now dominate U.S. intelligence. And it's a lot of our companies that everybody knows, like Booz Allen Hamilton, SAIC. There's a few others that people don't know very much about, like Leidos, which probably nobody's heard of. But these companies control a huge amount of what happens in intelligence, and they profit from it, as well as secret military operations. So I think it's imperative to include the private interests in this in just your general reporting about intelligence.
And as you report, these contracting firms are backed up by private equity firms.
Private equity is playing a key role in the development and the growth of U.S. intelligence contracting and defense contracting industries. Because as I described in that article I wrote in The Nation a couple of weeks ago, private equity funds, starting with the Carlyle Group, the well-known Carlyle Group, they have, they're led by former high-ranking government officials, U.S. government officials, many of them from intelligence, many of them from the Pentagon, who know and have deep knowledge of the spending habits of U.S., government agencies, intelligence agencies, and know what the spending is going to be like way into the future. And so, and they help steer capital into these companies, and they play a very important role, as I described there, in mergers and acquisitions, which, of course, create these sort of mega companies that now, dominate intelligence and defense. And so, I think it's imperative to look at, the role of these private equity funds as well. And they're particularly important now because President Trump is so dependent now on executives from private equity, who are helping, run the White House and run the government.
Tim Shorrock is an investigative journalist who's been writing about contractors and the privatization of war for many years. He's got a piece out in The Nation called Kushner and Bannon Team Up to Privatize the War in Afghanistan. He's also author of the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Tim, according to this New York Times report, Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner are pushing for Eric Prince, founder of the mercenary army Blackwater, to take over the war in Afghanistan. And he made the rounds on the radio. This is someone you don't hear much of. He's the brother of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, which I did not hear in these interviews, but he was interviewed on NPR's Morning Edition and also on Point. Can you talk about what you think, if you have an opportunity to interview someone like Eric Prince, which we hardly hear from these guys, what would you ask him?
I'd say, how do you live with yourself making money from war? How do you profit from bloodshed? How do you do that? That's one thing I would ask. I mean, I think that's what it comes down to. I mean, it's mercenary hardly does justice to what they do. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people profit from war and blood. The more war there is, the more they profit. And I think it's criminal the way that the media just kind of like talks about it as if it's kind of a side. They avoid the fact that these guys are making money from this. And I think that's sort of, those are the kinds of questions you need to ask. I mean, it is interesting that, Prince for so long was kind of, behind the scenes kind of guy and didn't appear in the media hardly at all. And suddenly he's making, giving these kind of interviews. And I think the question he needs to be asked is, why? Who's pushing this? And, it's clearly it's being pushed from the highest levels of the White House. although you never know where Bannon stands on a day-to-day basis. But he seems to be the, you know, the guy who's been really behind this, and his, you know, publication Breitbart has been proselytizing for Eric Prince for quite some time, as have other people that are working for Trump in the White House. In my opinion, though, I think it's very unlikely that Mattis, the Secretary of Defense Mattis, would want to rely on mercenary forces to do the actual fighting that the U.S. does in Afghanistan or any place. I think the much more likely scenario is a company like DynCorp doing what it already does, which is sort of run the whole logistics operations for the U.S. military in places like Afghanistan, which is what they're doing now. A couple of months ago, Trump had this idea of sort of creating security zones in Syria as U.S. and Russia collaborate on trying to wind down the war there. And I think these security zones, it's perfect opportunity for a company like DynCorp, because that's actually what they do. They operate in these kinds of zones, and that's where they make their money.
Tim, we'll talk about DynCorp in a minute, but first, just quickly on Eric Prince. This came up very briefly in the NPR interview, but back in 2015, I'm reading right now from the Washington Post, a federal judge sentenced a former Blackwater Worldwide security guard to life in prison and three others to 30-year terms for killing 14 unarmed civilians in a Baghdad traffic circle in 2007. So that's really important to point out. Steve Inskeep brought that up very briefly with Eric Prince. I was hoping that he would have pushed him harder on that. But this didn't come up at all. Last year, The Intercept, Jeremy Scahill and Matthew Cole reported that the Department of Justice is investigating Eric Prince for attempting to broker military services to foreign governments and possible money laundering. And for this story, no one would talk to them on the record, but they did speak with a number of former Eric Prince colleagues about this. He's trying to do business in Libya, for example, business with a Chinese bank, a lot of money laundering. This didn't come up at all in the interview.
No, and I think that's shameful because, you know, like Blackwater people that were convicted for killing the civilians. I mean, the question to Prince is, why should anyone trust, you know, a private army when you're responsible for such a massacre? I mean, where is the oversight? How do you fit into the chain of command? I mean, who's responsible for this? Who's ultimately responsible? Are you responsible? Should you be accused of murder too, since you own this company and employ these people? I mean, there needs to be hard questions asked of people like that instead of just letting them spout off their theories about how great and money-saving their privatization ideas will be. I mean, we're talking about people being slaughtered by private security people, mercenaries. And there's no oversight. As this government report I'm talking about that's going to come out next week says, that, you know, the U.S. government has no way of even tracking the money it spends in a place like Afghanistan. So where is the oversight? How can you turn over such operations to private companies that take no responsibility for what happens under their watch?
What is the end game for someone like Eric Prince? I mean, what does he want to do exactly in Afghanistan? Is it about money? What is it about ultimately?
I think it's ultimately about money for him, but I mean, he sees himself as somehow, you know, that his ideas are reminiscent of how the British ruled, Afghanistan in the past, you know, sort of, you know, the British style of imperialism. And like, you know, I think I wrote this, you know, months ago in an article I did about the counterinsurgency in Afghanistan. You know, if the U.S. wants to run these kinds of operations in places like Afghanistan, we've already been there almost 20 years now. It's going to be like British imperialism in the 1800s, you know, where the U.S. stays there for 100 years. I mean, look, we've been in South Korea now for, you know, 60, 70 years, same with Japan. I mean, so we're almost becoming like the British, you know, almost a century of occupation in certain parts of the world. And I think what he's talking about is like being the private, you know, army for that kind of imperialism, U.S. control paid with, you know, private military forces, you know, supplying the firepower. And it's a completely, you know, backward Neanderthal idea, but he's getting tons of press for it. And I think, you know, they're clearly, you know, getting a hearing at the Pentagon.
And just quickly, Tim, what do we need to know about DynCorp and its founder, Steven Feinberg? DynCorp is the largest U.S. contractor in Afghanistan. They're also a contractor in Iraq.
Right. Well, Feinberg's he's the CEO of a private equity fund called Cerberus Capital. That's it like the other ones I described earlier, relies heavily on, you know, former U.S. officials to sort of, you know, manage the capital. In Cerberus's case, the key figure is Dan Quayle. He used to be the vice president for the George Bush Senior, and he's played a key role in Cerberus for 10, 15 years. These companies got their start, you know, buying distressed assets, bankrupt companies in Asia during the Asia financial crisis, and also prior to that, in, you know, when the banking crisis hit the U.S. in the 1980s. So they're practiced at, you know, buying and selling companies, making huge profits from doing that. And in Cerberus's case, they've moved heavily into national security and intelligence and military in the last 5 or 10 years or so, and not only bought, you know, DynCorp, but they bought a bunch of other companies. But they have very high, you know, high-ranking former U.S. officials, such as Mike Morrell of the CIA, formerly of the CIA, advising them, as well as Leon, you know, Panetta, who used to run the CIA for Obama. He's been an advisor to Feinberg. And so, you know, they rely on people like that to, you know, clue them into the potential market, quote-unquote, and then they make their investments, and they buy companies that they think can exploit those markets. So it's, you know, it's a strategy that makes them a lot of money. I mean, these are very, very powerful. They control a lot of wealth. And they're, like I said before, they're playing a big role in sort of the, you know, the organization of the intelligence contracting industry.
Well, we will definitely continue to follow this because it deserves far more attention and far, far more scrutiny. Tim, we've got just a couple minutes left, and I just want to ask you a few questions about healthcare. You were up late last night. I was up not as late as you last night, but the Republicans voted on this bill at about 1:30 in the morning. What's striking me this morning is that there's all these headlines about how John McCain saved the day. Senators John McCain, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski voted against the latest plan that would have stripped 16 million people from health care, would have drastically cut Medicaid. And yet, you know, these two women have been no for a while now, but John McCain comes out, and now all of a sudden John McCain's the hero. But I think the real headline, Tim, is that 45 Senate Republicans voted for this bill. I mean, this is an extreme policy to take away health care from 16 million people. And then a couple days ago, 49 Republicans voted to take away health care from 22 million Americans. Medicaid cuts, and then, of course, the tax cut, which isn't getting much attention. It was a $1 trillion tax cut for the ultra-wealthy in this bill. What are your thoughts about how this is being covered?
Well, I think it's being covered, you know, pretty well, actually, you know, generally in the press. I found, you know, the whole focus on McCain was a little sickening, although, of course, you know, it was interesting to see how he voted last night. He kind of, you know, he made a big theater out of it by keeping it secret until the very last moment. But I think, you know, the two women Republicans that, you know, that voted against Trump on this and voted against their party on this are, you know, equally important. But I think really we have to, you know, look at the vast protests that went on in D.C. and in Congress over the last few weeks. I mean, these people that, especially people with, you know, disabilities, who put themselves on the line and were arrested time and time again and made all this noise when they were voting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how this thing was turned around. It was public protest. It was not, it was not, you know, these heroic, you know, Congress, you know, heroic senators voting against their party. It was these people that lay their lives on the line. And some of them, you know, these pictures of people in wheelchairs with their hands, you know, lashed behind their backs by cops, that's what did this. And I think, I think we have to look at this as a real victory for people power in the United States, because I think without those protests, you know, this vote would have gone the other way.
It's such a good point. Yesterday we had Anita Cameron on the show. She's a disability rights activist with ADAPT. And Tim, she's been arrested 131 times.
I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, these are the real heroes of this. And they knew how this could affect them. I mean, the cuts in Medicaid were just, I mean, it was just criminal. It's just like, it's a death sentence for people who depend on this kind of support for their health, for their lives. And the fact that that many Republicans voting, you know, to cut off that many people from basic health care just shows you how sick this society has become, and how just fascistic our government and our Congress is.
Yeah, again, 49 Republicans voted to strip health care away from 22 million Americans, and 45 Republicans voted to strip health care away from 16 million Americans. Margarita George was on Democracy Now! This morning. She's co-executive director of Healthcare for America Now! And Tim, she made a good point and said, you know, this is not done, because these Medicaid cuts are in Paul Ryan's House budget. So they're going to continue to try to get these cuts.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is going to be a long fight, and I think it's clear that the Republicans in the Senate are, you know, from what they said last night, they're like throwing in the towel on this. But you know, they have power in the House and the Senate to push all kinds of evil laws through, and this is going to keep happening.
Well, Tim Shorrock, thank you so much for joining us, and as always, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you very much. Great. Love being on your show.
Thank you. Tim has been writing about a number of issues, but mainly contractors and the privatization of war. You can find his latest story about Kushner and Bannon teaming up to privatize the war in Afghanistan at yourcallradio.org. And we will continue our coverage of health care. I hope you can join us on Monday. We're going to talk about the health insurance industry. We'll talk about its history, major players, how it operates, how it makes decisions, and its profits. I hope you can join us for that. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Ashley Ann Krigbaum for line producing today's show. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.